I made the acquaintance of Pycroft in this very smoking room. I was a young, nervous, new member, and he saw it. I was sitting all alone, wishing I knew more of the members, and suddenly he came, a great rolling front of chins and abdomina towards me, and grunted and sat down in a chair close by me, and wheezed for a space and scraped for a space with a match and lit a cigar, and then addressed me. He talked about various things and came round to games, and thence to my figure and complexion.
"You ought to be a good cricketer," he said.
"I suppose I am slender, slender to what some people would call lean, and I suppose I am rather dark. Still, I am not ashamed of having a Hindu great-grandmother, but for all that I don't want casual strangers to see through me at a glance to her, so that I was set against Pycroft from the beginning." But he only talked about me in order to get to himself.
"I expect," he said, "you take no more exercise than I do, and probably eat no less."
Like all excessively obese people, he fancied he ate nothing.
"Yet," and he smiled an oblique smile, "we differ."
And then he began to talk about his fatness, all he did for his fatness, all he was going to do for his fatness, what people had advised him to do for his fatness, and what he had heard of people doing for fatness similar to his.
"A priori," he said, "one would think a question of nutrition could be answered by diet, and a question of assimilation by drugs."
It was stifling, it was dumpling talk. It made me feel swelled to hear him. He came to the actual thing one day.
"Our pharmacopoeia," he said, "our Western pharmacopoeia is anything but the last word of medical science. In the East, I've been told..."
He stopped and stared at me. It was like being at an aquarium. I was quite suddenly angry with him. "Look here, who told you about my great-grandmother's recipes? Every time we've met for a week, and we've met pretty often, you've given me a broad hint or so about that little secret of mine."
"Well," he said, "now the cat's out of the bag, I'll admit, yes, it is so. I had it."
"From Patterson?" I said. "I wager it was Patterson."
Indirectly," he said,
which I believe was lying.
"Yes."
"Patterson," I said, "took that stuff at his own risk." He pursed his mouth and bowed. "My great-grandmother's recipes," I said, "are queer things to handle." I own I was weak, but I was also annoyed with Pycroft. I had got to that state of feeling for him that disposed me to say, "Well, take the risk." The little affair of Patterson, to which I have alluded, was a different matter altogether. What it was doesn't concern us now, but I knew anyhow that the particular recipe I used then was safe. The rest I didn't know so much about, and on the whole I was inclined to doubt their safety pretty completely. Yet even if Pycroft got poisoned, I must confess the poisoning of Pycroft struck me as an immense undertaking. That evening I took that queer, odd-scented sandalwood box out of my safe and turned the rustling skins over. The gentleman who wrote the recipes for my great-grandmother evidently had a weakness for skins of a miscellaneous origin, and his handwriting was cramped to the last degree. But I found the one that I knew was there soon enough, and sat on the floor by my safe for some time, looking at it. "Look here," I said to Pycroft next day, and snatched the slip away from his eager grasp. "So far as I can make it out, this is a recipe for loss of weight."
"Ah,"
said Pycroft. "I'm not absolutely sure, but I think it's that." I made him promise never to say a word to me about his disgusting fatness again, whatever happened. Never. And then I handed him that little piece of skin. "It's nasty stuff," I said.
"No matter,"
he said, and took it. He goggled at it.
But...
He had just discovered that it wasn't English. "To the best of my ability," I said, "I will do you a translation." I did my best. After that, we didn't speak for a fortnight. And then he got a word in.
"I must speak," he said. "It isn't fair. There's something wrong. It's done me no good. You're not doing your great-grandmother justice."
"Where's the recipe?" He produced it gingerly from his pocketbook. I ran my eye over the items. "Was the egg addled?" I said.
"No. Ought it to have been?"
That, I said, goes without saying in all my poor dear great-grandmother's recipes. When condition or quality is not specified, you must get the worst. She was drastic or nothing. And there's one or two possible alternatives to some of these other things. You got fresh rattlesnake venom?
I got rattlesnake from Jamrax. It cost...
That's your affair, anyhow. What about this last item?
I did my best. I know a man who...
Yes. Well, I'll write the alternatives down. So far as I know the language, the spelling of this recipe is particularly atrocious. By the by, dog here probably means paria dog. For a month after that, I saw Pycroft constantly at the club, and as fat and anxious as ever. He kept our treaty, but at times he broke the spirit of it by shaking his head despondently. And then, quite unexpectedly, his telegram came.
For heaven's sake, come, Pycroft.
Pycroft inhabited the upper half of a house in Bloomsbury, and I went there as soon as I had done my coffee and liqueur. Mr. Pycroft, I said, at the front door. They believed he was ill. He hadn't been out for 2 days. He expects me, I said, and they sent me up. I rang the bell at the door on the landing. He shouldn't have tried it anyhow, I said to myself. A man who eats like a pig ought to look like a pig. There came a call from inside the door.
That you, Formalin?
That you, Pycroft. Then I could hear a curious pattering upon the door, almost like someone feeling for the handle in the dark, and Pycroft's familiar grunts. I heard the key turn. Then Pycroft's voice said,
Come in.
I turned the handle and opened the door. Naturally, I expected to see Pycroft. Well, you know, he wasn't there. I never had such a shock in my life. There was his sitting room, in a state of untidy disorder, plates and dishes among the books and writing things, and several chairs overturned, but Pycroft...
It's all right, old man. Shut the door,
he said. And then I discovered him. There he was, right up close to the cornice in the corner by the door, as though someone had glued him to the ceiling. His face was anxious and angry. He panted and gesticulated.
Shut the door.
I shut the door and went and stood away from him and stared. If anything gives way and you tumble down, I said, you break your neck, Pycroft.
I wish I could,
he said. A man of your age and weight, getting up to childish gymnastics.
Don't,
he said, and looked agonized.
Your damned great-grandmother.
Be careful, I said. Anyway, how the deuce are you holding on up there? And then, abruptly, I realized that he was not holding on at all, that he was floating up there, just as a gas-filled bladder might have floated in the same position. He began a struggle to thrust himself away from the ceiling and to clamber down the wall to me, panting.
It's that prescription, he said. Too successful.
How?
Loss of weight. Almost complete.
And then, of course, I understood. By Jove, Pycroft, I said, what you wanted was a cure for fatness. But you always called it weight. You would call it weight. Somehow, I was extremely delighted. I quite liked Pycroft for the time. Let me help you, I said, and took his hand and pulled him down. He kicked about, trying to get a foothold somewhere. It was very like holding a flag on a windy day.
That table, he said, pointing, is solid mahogany and very heavy. If you can put me under that...
I did, and there he wallowed about like a captive balloon, while I stood on his hearthrug and talked to him. I lit a cigar. Tell me, I said, what happened?
I took it, he said. And then I kept on getting lighter and lighter and helpless, you know.
He gave way suddenly to a burst of passion.
What the goodness am I to do?
There's one thing pretty evident, I said, that you mustn't do. If you go out of doors, you'll go up and up. I waved an arm upward.
I suppose it will wear off.
I shook my head. I don't think you can count on that. And then there was another burst of passion, and he kicked out at adjacent chairs and banged the floor. He behaved just as I should have expected a great, fat, self-indulgent man to behave under trying circumstances, that is to say, very badly. He spoke of me and of my great-grandmother with an utter want of discretion. I never asked you to take the stuff, I said. And generously disregarding the insults he was putting upon me, I sat down in his armchair and began to talk to him in a sober, friendly fashion. I suggested that it would not be difficult for him to learn to walk about on the ceiling with his hands.
"I can't sleep," he said.
But that was no great difficulty. It was quite possible, I pointed out, to make a shake-up under a wire mattress, fasten the underthings on with tapes, and have a blanket, sheet, and coverlid to button at the side. He would have to confide in his housekeeper, I said, and after some squabbling he agreed to that. He could have a library ladder in his room, and all his meals could be laid on the top of his bookcase. And we agreed there must be iron staples along the skirting so that he could cling to those whenever he wanted to get about the room on the lower level. As we got on with the thing, I found myself almost keenly interested. In fact, I spent 2 whole days at his flat. I'm a handy, interfering sort of man with a screwdriver, and I made all sorts of ingenious adaptations for him. Ran a wire to bring his bells within reach, turned all his electric lights up instead of down, and so on. The whole affair was extremely curious and interesting to me, and it was delightful to think of Pyecraft like some great fat blowfly crawling about on his ceiling and clambering down the lintel of his doors from one room to another, and never, never, never coming to the club any more. Then, you know, my fatal ingenuity got the better of me. I was sitting by his fire, drinking his whiskey, and he was up in his favourite corner by the cornice, tacking a turkey carpet to the ceiling, when the idea struck me. "By Jove, Pyecraft," I said, "all this is totally unnecessary." And before I could calculate the complete consequences of my notion, I blurted it out. "Lead underclothing," I said, and the mischief was done. Pyecraft received the thing almost in tears.
"To be right ways up again," he said.
I gave him the whole secret before I saw where it would take me. "Buy sheet lead," I said. "Stamp it into discs. Sew 'em all over your underclothes until you have enough. Have lead-soled boots. Carry a bag of solid lead. And the thing is done. Instead of being a prisoner here, you may go abroad again, Pyecraft." In his emotion, he dropped the tack hammer within an ace of my head.
"By Jove," he said, "I shall be able to come back to the club again."
The thing pulled me up short. "By Jove," I said. "Yes, of course. You will." He did. He does. There he sits behind me now, stuffing, as I live, a third go of buttered tea cake. And no one in the whole world knows, except his housekeeper and me, that he weighs practically nothing, that he is a mere boring mass of assimilatory matters, mere clouds in clothing, and most inconsiderable of men. There he sits, watching, until I have done this writing. Then, if he can, he will waylay me. He will come billowing up to me. He will tell me over again all about it, how it feels, how it doesn't feel, how he sometimes hopes it is passing off a little. And always, somewhere in that fat, abundant discourse, he will say, "The secret's keeping, eh? If anyone knew of it, I should be so ashamed. Makes a fellow look such a fool, you know, crawling about on a ceiling and all that." And now, to elude Pyecraft, occupying, as he does, an admirable strategic position between me and the door.